And that's what my book talks about different ways that people are collectively helping people who are being criminalized, and by doing so, actually showing that there are other understandings of justice and safety. In Tracy's case, that justice would have been not arresting her in the first place, but rather supporting her during a trauma that is unimaginable to so many of us.
And we're going to continue this discussion after the broadcast and post it at democracynow.org. You're listening to Jocelyn Simonson, law professor at Brooklyn College. Her new book is called Radical Acts of Justice, How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Incarceration. We're also going to continue talking with Tracy McCarter, domestic violence survivor, nurse, and grandmother. She just graduated from Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune into Democracy Now! Happy birthday to Paul Powell.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is community planted, watered, and grown. Our funding is cultivated by listeners like you. We are looking to harvest $55,000 for this fall drive to support our organic, bountiful programming. Take root by becoming a member today. Just go to kboo.fm/give to donate, or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, houseless Portlanders file a class action lawsuit against the city over the camping ban.
More on the report that demonstrates that drug decriminalization is not connected to increased overdose deaths.
And in national news, blue hydrogen may not be the answer to climate change woes.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 2nd, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ron Bronson. A group of unhoused Portlanders have filed a class action lawsuit against the city over the so-called camping ban ordinance that the city council passed over the summer. The lawsuit says that the restrictions violate Oregon law and the state constitution. It says that they subject people who are involuntarily without permanent shelter to unreasonable punishments for unavoidable activities like sleeping and staying dry. City commissioners voted to ban camping between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. and in certain overlapping areas of the city. Violators would receive a warning ticket, a $100 fine, and then 30 days in jail if they don't comply. The lawsuit alleges that all this is illegal. It reads, quote, "The ordinance subjects approximately 10,000 Portlanders living outside every night to 30 days in jail for violating a law that is impossible to understand or comply with," end quote. After passing the measure, the city said they'd back off from enforcement for a time, but they plan to start enforcing the rules in the next couple of weeks. Cody Bowman, a spokesperson for Mayor Ted Wheeler, said they will provide 2 weeks' notice before they start enforcement.
The distance between Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and the other city commissioners appears to be growing as the new form of government passed by voters approaches. Willamette Week reports that Wheeler's plans to move the government towards the transition is being met with resistance. He told commissioners in a September 26th letter that he wants to hire a city administrator at least 6 months before the new government starts on January 1st, 2025. He also wants to start renovating City Hall no later than the beginning of 2024. It will now have to accommodate 12 city councilors and will cost more the longer construction is delayed. Wheeler is also reportedly considering pulling all city bureaus under his control before 2025. Other city commissioners didn't like that plan. They want to keep their bureaus and keep the cost of the transition down. Instead of six deputy city administrators managing things until 2025, they want three. They propose giving each city councilor just one dedicated staffer and sharing other administrative staff to cut costs. Their offices wrote, quote, simply put, how we finish the commission form of government also matters. Our argument is that this should and must be a truly collective endeavor, end quote. A work schedule on that transition is scheduled for tomorrow.
New research from the CDC finds that Oregon's drug decriminalization law, Measure 1110, didn't contribute to an uptick in overdose deaths. KBOO's Doug McBay spoke with the lead author of the study to learn more.
New research published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry finds that decriminalization of possession of some drugs in Oregon and Washington was not responsible for an increase in overdose deaths. I spoke with the lead author of the study, Dr. Spruha Joshi, to find out more.
We were interested in evaluating two legal changes in drug possession laws in Oregon and Washington. So first in Oregon, we were interested in studying the impact of what we'll call Measure 110. Measure 110 went into effect on February 1st of 2021. And we were interested to see what happened with overdoses given this sort of policy implementation. Similarly, in Washington, there was the Blake decision that happened with a Supreme Court decision, the State versus Blake, which went into effect later that same month on February 25th, 2021. And similarly, went to look at overdoses in that to see what happened with overdoses in those states. And the reason why we wanted to look at overdoses in as sort of an outcome of this is that the overdose crisis is continuing. Reducing overdoses is a clear public health goal. And removing sort of criminal penalties for drug possession have the potential to reduce overdoses due to potential reduction in sort of the fear of engagement with law enforcement, so potentially increases for calls for help. And then also Measure 110 had a second aspect where it was increasing funds to treatment access from the cannabis tax revenue. And so what we did was we implemented what is known as a synthetic control method to be able to assess sort of what would have happened in each of these states had these legal changes not occurred.
What'd you find?
Yeah. And so what we found was that in both of those states, we found that while we did see an increase in overdose, which parallels what's happening across the country, these increases in overdose were not associated with these policy changes in either of the states.
That was part of my interview with Professor Spruha Joshi, PhD, MPH, lead author of an article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled 1 Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington. My full interview with Dr. Joshi airs later on KBOO on this evening's edition of Prison Pipeline, starting at 6:30 p.m. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
A memo from the Biden administration directs federal agencies to find a way to restore dwindling salmon populations in the Northwest. That could include breaching the lower Snake River dams in southeast Washington. Eric Tagetoff has the details.
The Biden administration wants to get serious about restoring salmon populations to the Northwest. A presidential memorandum directs federal agencies to assess how they can improve fish numbers in the Columbia River Basin. Mitch Cutter with the Idaho Conservation League applauds the memo, saying other presidents have dodged the issue because it is tricky to address.
What we're seeing that's very different about this administration is that they are ready to embrace that complexity and ready to get to a level of how do we solve this problem? We've been putting this off across multiple administrations for 30 years now. How do we move this issue forward?
Cutter says salmon and steelhead populations over the past few decades have been in severe decline in the Columbia River Basin, including on the Snake River stretching into Idaho. Cutter adds working with indigenous tribes is also prominent in the presidential memo.
We're seeing this administration treat tribal justice much more seriously than past administrations have, and at least say the right things about how it is paying attention to what tribes want and is going to factor them in, not just as stakeholders, but as co-equal partners.
Cutter says breaching the four lower Snake River dams in southeast Washington is important, especially for Idaho fish. He says the Bonneville Power administration is critical to this decision.
Because Bonneville Power, in large part, controls these dams and the energy that is created from them, they are the key player, and they are someone that we would like this administration to really take a close look at in regards to how they're treating these fish.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Multnomah County Commissioners voted 4-1 last week in favor of a new plan to address gaps in the region's homelessness response. It ended with a tense exchange between Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vader Pedersen and Commissioner Sharon Marin. $62 million in revenue will go towards emergency homeless shelters, outdoor villages, detox centers, day shelters, and housing for people getting out of substance abuse treatment recovery programs. The plan specifically creates 175 shelter beds for adults, 30 for families with children, and 10 for young adults. Nearly $500,000 will be steered towards organizations aiming to open outdoor pod villages. Pedersen drafted the plan. She said, quote, "When I ran for this office, it was to solve big, tough problems. There have been no bigger or tougher problem than digging in as hard as we can to turn the tide on the dual crises of homelessness and substance abuse in our communities. There is time to be resolute, and that time is now," end quote. The funding comes from an unexpected $50 million in additional revenue from the regional tax supporting housing services. Metro alerted the county to this money in August. Earlier this month, the county also learned it had $10 million in unused federal Emergency Rescue Plan, American Rescue Plan Act money. The board previously approved $16 million for temporary alternative shelters, but they've only opened one large adult outdoor shelter. The new funding will make it possible for the county to open two more. County commissioners have been debating how to best spend unexpected funds. While all commissioners supported the funding of the city shelters, some raised concerns about how long it may take for that money to be used.
A large point of contention for commissioners was how to spend money on drug and alcohol abuse treatment programs. The proposed spending plan pledges $6.8 million to create a 24/7 stabilization center, a residential space with 20 beds for people at risk of houselessness to stay in after leaving drug detox. 8 beds would be reserved for intoxicated people who are picked up by police or other providers. It's not yet known how long people would be allowed to stay at this facility. Commissioner Mirren, a practicing emergency medicine doctor, says the county should be investing more resources into a higher capacity drop-off sobering center. She says the plan feels rushed, and she cast the lone vote opposing it. Mirren said, quote, "It's like someone opened a Cliff's Notes on behavioral health to write an essay at the last minute, because it was overdue and hoped the teacher would notice that. I am disgusted by this proposal," end quote. Vega Pedersen told Mirren that her comments about county staff and commissioners were, quote, "out of line." Pedersen said, quote, "You are never allowed to impugn the motives of your colleagues, and I'm not going to stand for it here," end quote. Other commissioners expressed concern about not funding a larger drop-off center to replace Portland's sobering and detox center, which closed in 2019. The funding package also includes money for eviction defense and rent assistance for people at risk of homelessness, plus funds to support housing programs for people in recovery. This is the second batch of homeless services dollars the county has been asked to distribute this year. Multnomah County ended the fiscal year in June with $42 million of supportive housing tax dollars and spent. At the time, county officials said they were unable to distribute the funds due to low wages and staffing shortages at the nonprofits they contract with. The county estimates that some 6,200 people are sleeping unsheltered each night in Multnomah County.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy dares House Republicans to unseat him. President Biden assures allies funding for Ukraine will continue, and the Congressional Black Caucus said a black woman should oppose Senator Feinstein. With this and more, on the story is Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
If somebody wants to make a motion against me, bring it. There has to be an adult in the room. I am going to govern with what is best for this country.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is under pressure for a last-minute deal with Democrats on a spending resolution to avoid a government shutdown. Ultra-conservative Florida Republican Matt Gaetz says he'll file a motion to unseat McCarthy this week, saying the speaker lied about spending cuts and border policies. The stopgap measure moves the spending deadline to mid-November. It includes $16 billion in disaster relief at home, but no aid for Ukraine. President Biden is pressing for a separate aid package as soon as possible.
And I want to assure our American allies and the American people and the people of Ukraine that you can count on our support. We will not walk away.
Senate leaders say there's strong bipartisan support there for uninterrupted Ukraine funding. California Governor Gavin Newsom has chosen a replacement for Senator Dianne Feinstein. Newsom named Emily's List president LaFonza Butler, a black woman but not one running for the seat. One of the candidates is Representative Barbara Lee of Oakland, who has been endorsed by the Congressional Black Caucus and points out before this appointment, the Senate had no black women in it.
The Senate needs a perspective that I bring with my life experiences as a progressive black woman.
Federal student loan payments restart this month. Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts calls it a crisis for black college graduates who carry an average of $25,000 more debt than their white peers.
It takes a psychological toll. It chokes at the promise of our families, our communities, and our country.
The Supreme Court rejected a Biden administration proposal to cancel up to $20,000 in debt. The administration says its Save Income-based repayment plan can still dramatically reduce monthly payments and interest charges and even totally forgive many loans. Today marks the start of Banned Books Week. PEN America says there have been more than 3,000 book bans in public schools and libraries over the past year, mostly from far-right groups targeting women, people of color, or LGBTQ authors. Moms for Liberty co-founder Tiffany Justice says they want to protect children.
Parental rights do not stop at the classroom door. We do not co-parent with the government.
More than 40% of all recent book bans have occurred in Florida school districts. A lawsuit filed in Michigan aims to keep former President Donald Trump off the state's presidential ballot. The group Free Speech for People contends Trump is disqualified because he participated in an insurrection to overturn the last election. Dozens of similar suits have been filed in other states. Meanwhile, Trump says he'll be in the courtroom when his civil trial for extensive business fraud starts in New York. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview on the Best States to Work report. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 51. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a high of 67 degrees. Today in history, in 2022, American actress and activist for Native American civil rights, Sasheen Littlefeather, passed away. The quote of the day is from boxer Muhammad Ali, who said, quote, "Service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth."
Native groups are urging officials to keep the shooter from an anti-statue rally in New Mexico in jail. With that and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native groups and their allies are calling on officials to condemn violence against indigenous people and to keep a suspect charged with attempted murder locked up. The Red Nation, Three Sisters Collective, Kiva Club, Indian Collective, and their allies say last week's shooting at a prayerful event in New Mexico, celebrating the halt of the placement of a Juan de Oñate statue, was a racist attack. Witnesses say before the shooting, the suspect was seen antagonizing the crowd gathered at the Rio Arriba County Annex building in Española. Video recorded at the event, widely shared on social media, shows the suspect wearing a hoodie and a red Make America Great Again hat, scuffling with people at the gathering before pulling out a gun and shooting one person and pointing the gun at another before fleeing. Police identified the shooter as 23-year-old Ryan Martinez. He was arrested and charged with attempted murder in the first degree and aggravated assault, use of a deadly weapon. Martinez is due to appear in court Monday. Native groups and their allies are calling on officials to not release him and to recognize the shooting as a racially motivated hate crime. The person shot was identified as 42-year-old Jacob Johns. A GoFundMe set up for his medical bills says he's Hopi and Akmel Autumn and has dedicated his life to Indigenous and climate justice. The statue was previously removed from a different location in 2020 and was set to be put up last week at its new location in front of the county building, but was postponed. Members of the Native groups fighting against the statue say Oñate was a brutal Spanish colonizer, and the statue represents violence and genocide. Canada's western province of Manitoba could make history. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it could elect its first First Nations premier to lead the provincial government.
Wab Kanu is the leader of the New Democratic Party of Manitoba. He was born in Ontario and lived on the Anigaming First Nation. His father was a survivor of the residential school system, and Kanu says he passed to Kanu the importance of Anishinaabe culture and language. During a recent televised debate, Kanu blasted the former premier of Manitoba for closing emergency rooms and breaking the healthcare system.
I don't think too many of us understood how having to drive further was going to get you seen quicker. We have a plan to fix it. Let me be clear, this is going to be hard work. It has to start with staffing up the healthcare system, and then once the staffing is stabilized, 2 years from now, we put shovels into the ground to build a new ER starting in South Winnipeg.
If elected, Kanu would become the first First Nations premier, but not the first Indigenous premier. John Norquay, who was Métis, was Manitoba's fifth premier until 1887. Kanu says there are still historic barriers to overcome, the main reason few Indigenous people enter provincial politics. Some analysts say if Kanu becomes premier, it would be significant because there are still dominant stereotypes that see Indigenous people in a negative way. So it's important for other Indigenous people to see that it's possible to succeed at the highest levels. Manitobans go to the polls on October the 3rd. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The memorial at Wounded Knee, one of the most prominent landmarks on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, was recently vandalized. The memorial was placed in the early 1900s by Joseph Horncloud, a direct descendant of victims of the Wounded Knee Massacre. The damages were limited to the topmost piece of the monument structure. The site is under the management of Oglala Sioux Tribal Government, which has indicated plans to increase efforts to protect the memorial. Assistant U.S. Attorney Elliot Neal has been picked to represent missing or murdered Indigenous persons for the Southwest region. The region includes New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, and Arizona. He's one of five assistant U.S. attorneys who will provide support to U.S. attorneys' offices to address the issue. His background and experience includes working with tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Governor Tina Kotek is set to give out $240 million in grants and loans to Oregon tech companies. The money will go to 15 Oregon companies that work in the semiconductor industry. Those companies predict they will invest more than $40 billion in Oregon in total and provide more than 6,000 jobs. Governor Kotek said in a statement, quote, "When we look back a decade from now, I truly believe we'll be proud of this effort and the positive impact it will make for Oregonians and our country," end quote. Others were skeptical about whether or not the state money is a deciding factor for companies choosing to expand. Daniel Hauser is deputy director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. He said, quote, "It's impossible to know how much of this new industry activity is really contingent on public funding. There are other things we can invest in that would have, there are other things we can invest in that would have an economic impact. Somebody's going to need to take care of those workers' kids, and we're going to need somewhere for them to live," end quote. In recent years, states and U.S. federal government have been working to incentivize and grow domestic chip making after years of industry outsourcing the work. Oregon semiconductor workers make up 15% of the total national workforce.
The hype surrounding blue hydrogen as a clean energy alternative isn't backed up by science, experts say. That's despite the U.S. Department of Energy models that argue that it is. Experts say banking on blue hydrogen technology could worsen climate change instead of mitigating its effects. Nadia Ramagan has more on this story.
New research from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis finds making hydrogen from natural gas, so-called blue hydrogen, isn't much better than burning fossil fuels and will waste billions in federal spending. David Schlissel with the Institute and co-author of the study says people should be paying attention to this issue because the federal government is banking on blue hydrogen technology that he says could worsen climate change instead of mitigating its effects.
The
government is planning to spend maybe upwards of $70 billion on subsidies related to hydrogen. There are a lot of uncertainties with the technology and with factors like how much natural gas, which is used in the production of blue hydrogen, how much is going to leak into the atmosphere.
In addition, the report finds government agencies may be significantly understating the environmental impact of methane, the primary component of natural gas. Fossil fuel companies argue that blue hydrogen produced from methane or coal can be manufactured cleanly and is part of the solution to the climate crisis. Schlissel contends that U.S. Department of Energy models are also based on an extremely optimistic set of assumptions about future carbon capture technology. Models currently estimate the majority of the carbon dioxide produced at blue hydrogen facilities will be captured.
There's no facility in the world that captures anywhere near that much carbon dioxide, and the testing that's gone on to date is relatively small scale.
According to the report, carbon dioxide emissions involved in fully compressing, storing, and transporting the hydrogen to the site where it will be used is more than three times as much as the Department of Energy's clean hydrogen standard. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
Tens of thousands of women marched in Latin America last week to commemorate International Safe Abortion Day. Supporters have spent decades fighting to roll back strict abortion prohibitions, although there are still relatively few countries with a total ban. In Mexico, marchers celebrated a recent decision by the country's Supreme Court to decriminalize abortions at the federal level. Thousands of women waved green handkerchiefs, which have become the symbol for Latin America's Green Wave abortion movement. Signs reading, it's, quote, my decision, and, quote, free and safe abortions for everyone, and, quote, were seen in the crowd. In Argentina, marchers were worried that the strength of the populist far-right candidate could endanger abortion rights. Protesters also raised alarm about the region's high rate of gender-based violence, as well as abuses aimed at LGBTQ plus people. Mexico City was the first Mexican jurisdiction to make abortions legal 15 years ago. Argentina decriminalized the procedure in 2020, and in 2022, Colombia did the same. A case before Brazil's Supreme Court could potentially decriminalize the procedure there, too, up to 12 weeks of gestation.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 2nd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Chris Gao, David Rosenberg, Ender Black, and Doug McVeigh. The producer and engineer tonight is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ron Bronson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to our website at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Andrew Black. Oxfam America recently released this year's edition of its Best States to Work report. The report talks about the rapidly growing inequality in the country and shows which states are filling the gaps left by federal inaction in supporting workers and their families. KBOO's David Rosenberg spoke with Caitlin Henderson, a senior research advisor with Oxfam America's U.S. Domestic Policy Program, to learn more.
So the best states and the worst states, were you at all surprised at the results when you looked into this issue?
I wasn't super surprised by a lot of the results. We see a lot of consistency in performance at the top and the bottom of our index, states being really steady with either consistently providing a lot of support for working workers and working families or struggling to provide those policies that we track in the index. But every year there's some really exciting movement happening, usually with states around the middle, of showing real progress in different policy areas. So it's always an exciting project to update year over year.
And how do you define what are the best states to work in? Is it wages? Is it worker protection? What goes into that analysis?
Yeah, our index actually has 26 policies across three big themes, and those themes are wages, worker protections, and rights to organize. So the way we measure states is across all 26 areas. So that does include everything from minimum wages and tipped wages to paid leave and scheduling protections to also the ability for public and private workers to organize and collectively bargain.
It seems like some of the worst states, maybe all of them, are in the South. Any progress there at all?
The South is very consistent in terms of ending up at the bottom of our index, but there has been some important changes that have happened that I do like to highlight. A few years ago, there was a ballot initiative in Florida that passed by a very strong margin, which raised the minimum wage for the state. And as a result of that ballot initiative, which really was the voice of the people, because voters themselves put the initiative on, Florida moved up in our rankings. And another example that we really love to sort of lift up as an example of something that's great is Virginia jumped up our rankings pretty significantly since we started this index in 2018. When we first released the index, Virginia was at the very bottom, and now it's in the top half. And that's the result of a lot of great policies that were passed due to workers organizing and voters really advocating for a change. And policies that passed in Virginia that really impacted its ranking were a higher minimum wage, a domestic workers' bill of rights, the ability for public teachers to collectively bargain in the state. So change is very, very possible, and it's always very exciting to see when it happens.
Can a state move up in the rankings because certain cities pass progressive legislation, or does it have to be something that's done state?